Friday. It's high noon. It's Monday. This must be the tracks. Do you know where your military industrial complex is? Besides Afghanistan and Syria and Yemen and Saudi Arabia. Well, welcome to Stand in the Way. In the shade. We got it made in the shade.
Okay.
In the way,
that was yesterday at 5300 Portugal Highway, and on the federal complex, ammo.
There was a deeper meaning behind this propaganda, and so that's why I chose to become a journalist and wanted to expose the military-industrial complex for what it was. I wanted to expose that Islamophobia industry, And from there, I went on to work in independent journalism and, you know, do my own work and so forth. And I actually didn't wear hijab at the time, but later on, I decided to wear hijab. And then I soon actually became the first American, you know, woman to wear the hijab to anchor and report the news in American media. And so that was a very, very big deal. And at the time, many Muslims wouldn't go into journalism. I would go and get on the peak, and I was like, you know, we need to rise up and, like, represent ourselves in a better way, especially the woman, because there was this idea based from this propaganda that women, especially Muslim women, were oppressed. They couldn't think for themselves. They weren't powerful. They weren't independent. They weren't intelligent. And so this was obviously goes against, you know, reality. And so I would try to kind of gather Muslim women, like, we have to rise up and, you know, become part of the political atmosphere, become, you know, part of the media industry so that we can change perspectives. But they were so scared because they were let down by the media. And I just didn't allow that to happen. Failure was not an option in my perspective and in my heart. And so at that time, I had that hope and that, you know, the fact that I saw so many people let down by the media, that actually gave me more strength to carry on and continue. And things were getting really better for a while. But the Islamophobia industry has only grown. I believe it's worth over $3 million per year. We have special interest groups that, like, directly profit from war, who want to link, you know, Muslims to the war on terror and jihadis and ISIS and all of these things, when most of these terrorists are being funded by our own deep state and our intelligence community. And so, you know, we just, you know, it's just been a struggle to be able to expose those things, but it's also given, you know, rise and a bigger platform for people like myself to speak up.
And if you missed that, she mentioned the fact that we're arming our enemies out there. And on that very subject, of course, we're going to go to Manchester, where the son of Tunworth, was Ramadan Abedi's MI6 name when he took 40,000 to assassinate Gaddafi in 96. His son, Salman, was given the remote detonated package and sent to make his connection at the club. And so
reasons on very bad things while he was at MI5 Iraq and everything else, and spying on politicians. Let's just welcome him back to the program. You can follow him on Twitter. He's at @gods_spy. His website is davidshaler.com. Welcome back to our friend David Shaler. David, welcome back.
Thanks, Richie. Good to be back.
Nice to have you back on the show, mate. It's been a while. Good to have you on. You've been...
Oh, yeah. Let's go to that. Because this is a couple of years previous.
Discovering in your time at MI5 that MI6 were funding Al-Qaeda.
And we'll come in a second, David, to the news that Turkish opposition MPs are being accused of treason for telling the truth about how sarin gas was really used in Syria. It wasn't used by Bashar al-Assad's government forces. It was used by ISIS. It originated in Europe. We'll come to that in a second, and how the Turks have been dealing in oil with them. But I just want to remain with Hillary Benn for a minute. Of course, this is entirely speculative. It can't be anything else. But when you have a guy like Benn, the son of Tony Benn, legendary socialist, conviction politician, nobody would argue with that, whatever you think of him, he meant what he said, and he always maintained a certain line on the National Health Service and on incursions overseas. He was very, 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 very consistent. So when Benn says, as he did, I mean, when he spoke to the Huffington Post, and that interview is incredible because they videoed it, and, you know, he's almost dismissive, he's almost sarcastic in the way that he dismisses the idea of joining in bombing inside Syria. And, you know, he talks about, you know, he's basically saying, why add to the carnage and the madness there? Let's try and diplomatically end the violence and then we'll have a look at it. And yet 2 weeks later, he's given this aggressive, nasty, hostile, load of bollocks, let's be honest about it, speech that was accredited, or he was credited with having given one of the great speeches of all time. I can only guess, David, that somebody has said to Hillary, Hillary, have a look at some photographs that we took a couple of years ago.
Yeah, well, I mean, basically, that you can try and speculate these things, yeah, but you've also got to factor in things like human ego, how they do manipulate with information. Is Hillary Benn a member of the Privy Council, for example? Because sometimes that's what they can use. They can use the Privy Council oath to manipulate them to do their bidding, basically. They can essentially command them to vote the way they want to. So I'm not sure if he's a member of the Privy Council.
Yeah.
So there can be several reasons. Obviously, one of them can be intelligence service blackmail. But I say, without any other corroborating information, really all we're doing is speculating. What's more important, really, than talking about Hillary Benn is how so many Labour MPs in particular, but obviously the Tories voted as well, voted for a bombing campaign without any sense or reason or humanity about it. That's what we take from this. We can speculate about what people's motives all the time. And what that has done is it's opened up the fissure between the political class, which I'm calling the psycho-political class because it's full of psychopaths, and the people. And this, again, is part of what I also talk about, the wider spiritual awakening going on among mankind, that people admired in the political class just don't see it. And that's partly, again, you know, we're not so much they have to blackmail these people. What they do is they psychologically profile. We know, for example, Common Purpose, when they invite people to their meetings, they very quickly give them a psychological test. Those who don't comply, it's thanks very much, but no thanks, they're sent away. But the ones who will comply are the ones that will then be taken on the courses, because they know they have a particular psychology that can be manipulated. So we know it's all to do with things like psychological profiling as well. And then we wonder as well whether it's the use of technical information, technical mind control as well, because we know there's all sorts of experiments showing you can beam things into people's heads, you can play with their psychology in that way. And the only way to essentially resist that kind of thing is through a spiritual awakening. And I don't think Hillary Benn is a spiritual being. In fact, I know he's not a spiritual being, because no spiritual being, no one who genuinely believes in the one true God would vote for that war, because they understand the nature of karma. And they would
understand. Yeah, so I don't want to get distracted too much. That was 2 years ago talking about the general thing, but the specifics of the recent Manchester Post, well, it was the Libya Islamic fighting group, but that's us, basically, you know, the West's proxy.
It's been pretty busy, a lot going on. In fact, since you were on the program last, we've had a number of very serious incidents in the country, 4 terrorist attacks, the most recent, of course, being last week at Finsbury Mosque. And we're going to start off this evening, aren't we, talking about the attack at the Manchester Arena, which was carried out by Salman Abedi, allegedly. I say allegedly because that's what we've been told. We do know, though, that 22 people died and a lot of people were injured. And you've uncovered information about him and his father, and it's information that's not yet in the public domain, David. Do you want to talk a little bit about that as a way of beginning before we move on to other things? We'll cover a lot in the next hour or so. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, this is exclusive, Richie, at the moment. But it transpired when Salman Abedi, when this all came up, it turned out that his father, Ramadan Abedi, was arrested in Libya, and he's a member of what's known as the Islamic Fighting Group. Now, this man is also the agent Tunworth, who was essentially the Al Qaeda in Libya member, or the Islamic Fighting Front member, who approached MI6 to get the money to fund the operation. Obviously, he didn't actually take part in the operation, because otherwise he probably would have been killed. But clearly, this is the go-between. Now, this operation in Manchester, the bomb was said to be of a very sophisticated design. So we have an MI6 agent is the father of the suicide bomber, according to their story, basically. So the expertise he would have learnt from MI6, according to their logic, would have been used in that attack. So MI6 is implicated in this very clearly. I'm not saying they ordered the attack or anything like that. I'm saying the expertise they have given helped that attack go ahead, if we believe what they're saying, basically.
Agent Tunworth.
It gets worse, because when you look at the whole Abedi thing, him and another three guys from Manchester, who became known as the Manchester Taliban, in the noughties were travelling to Libya more or less at will. Now, these people are Islamic terrorists going over to Libya, and they seem to be able to go in and out of Britain with no problem at all. And each time they're going over, their aim is to try and assassinate Colonel Gaddafi. Now, to me, this is evidence that MI6 is working to the Zionist agenda. The Zionists have never liked Gaddafi, supported Abu Nidal, who carry out resistance in the West Bank and so on, the Gaza Strip. So the Zionists never liked him. He funded the IRA. These are resistance movements. In my mind, they were people who were opposing occupation in the only way they could, because the law had failed them. Obviously, from the Zionist viewpoint, this was made Gaddafi public enemy number one at one point. And it's absolutely clear, the more he tried to create rapprochement with the West, the more desperate MI6 were to have him assassinated. And I say, the operation I blew the whistle on in 96 made absolutely no sense, because by 1996, Gaddafi had given up terrorism, and yet we were funding this new group of people who MI5 knew even then were the new threat to the West, basically. So this is all the proof you need. I can show you other stuff. I'm going to be putting stuff up on the internet. There are documents that appeared in the past. There's another example of MI5 letting a Libyan terrorist into the country in the mid-1990s. Now, MI6 said they could recruit him. They got nowhere. This guy set up a terrorist network. And the document that appeared on the internet, you can see in that paragraph where MI5 actually have to admit that. They admit to government that by letting this in, he set up this terrorist network. So I was obviously involved in trying to expel him, basically. And in the end, we got an expulsion order against him and he had to leave. That combined with the idea that they allowed tens of thousands of Islamic terrorists into the UK, knowing they were terrorists. These weren't people who slipped in the mid-1990s. They knew these people were veterans of the Afghan-Soviet war, were therefore Mujahideen, were therefore Islamic extremists. But nevertheless, they let them settle in Britain. And this, obviously, is the background to what is going on now. Everything seems to have come full circle. It's all, well, I mean, in August, it'll be 20 years since I first blew the whistle, basically. So it's quite incredible that we've now come back to the idea of Tunworth again. Now, I have made this information about Ramadan Abedi, Tunworth, available to the Prime Minister. I emailed Number 10 using their official thing. I also sent it to the head of the Met, and I sent it to Jeremy Corbyn. Not one of them has got back to me.
Basically. Nobody's gotten back to you yet, David. Nobody.
Nobody.
When did you send the info? In the last couple of days, was it?
No, about a couple of weeks ago.
Jesus Christ. So in 2 weeks, nobody has said anything. Let's just go over this again. This is vital. So the Manchester bomber was named as Salman Abedi. Yes. Apparently, he was 22 years old. This happened on the 22nd. 22 people were killed. A lot of people make a lot out of that. We might talk about that, we might not. One of the things that we get asked all the time, did it happen? Was it a hoax? And all of this sort of nonsense. I know people who treated the injured and who dealt with the horrible cleanup afterwards. And I believe those people. And this was a terrible thing. People were killed. So his father was Agent Tunworth, basically. He was an asset of MI6, and he was used to basically undermine the Gaddafi regime, if you want to call it that, or government in Libya. Give our listeners, David, an idea of the timeline. A lot of people won't understand this. Give us the timeline.
This was in the mid-1990s. Posted to the Libyan desk, and I have a very good relation with MI6. That's why I was briefed on this operation. And obviously, this is one of the reasons why I left the service. Up to that point, I could still, in my conscience, say that I was trying to stop terrorism, as I saw it at the time. But this suddenly was me being party to a terrorist operation in which innocent people had died. Now, certain British commentators said that those deaths in the attempt on Gaddafi's life were merely collateral damage. Now, I think Manchester has put that into perspective. If anybody were to say what happened in Manchester to those young girls was merely collateral damage in some ongoing terrorist war, they would be drummed out of town, and quite deservedly so. Now, obviously, Libyan people aren't as close to us, but they are human beings. I was an atheist at the time. I believe so much in the sanctity of human life. That is why I blew the whistle. But let's think, Richie, what does this reveal about the country? 20 years ago, I blew the whistle on our intelligence operatives deciding foreign policy, because the Foreign Secretary of the day, Malcolm Rifkin, did not give permission for this, had no idea about it. So they're going off, deciding the power of life and death over people like Gaddafi, and obviously in the case of the attack in 96, which went wrong, the lives of innocent people, bystanders who were in the crowd meeting Gaddafi in the same way we have a meet and greet with the Prime Minister in this country. These people are innocent civilians. And as I said at the time, you remove Gaddafi, you remove the stability of Libya and possibly North Africa. That's all now come to pass in 2011.
And you believe, don't you, my friend, you believe that the chaos that follows the removal of these people was the plan all along, right?
Absolutely. Well, it's always been the plan, yeah, absolutely. Wherever they can, they will try and replace what were essentially more moderate governments, certainly by the standards of the region, people like Saddam and Gaddafi and so on, in the case of Assad now in Syria. These are the more westernized, the more outward-looking, mostly Islamic countries, but they were also pluralist countries as well. They weren't just purely Islamic countries. And what we've now replaced that with, obviously, is these extreme Islamic governments, and that's why we have attacks like in Manchester. You say it appears to be a real attack. How far that Salman Abedi's involved? I think it's impossible to say at this stage. They found a bank card in his pocket, supposedly, which is a kind of thing that we look for in what we might be a false flag operation, not in terms of it not happening, yeah. It obviously happened, but in terms of trying to blame somebody else for it, basically.
Somebody who mightn't have done it, yeah. David Shaler is on the line, folks. This is, I don't want to be, punning my way through the programme, but this is explosive. This is explosive stuff, this. I want to talk, just before we come back to, because some people will say, and they will, and I'm not trying to be the devil's advocate, but some people will say, well, look, this is what these dirty intelligence agencies do. They use people, they have their assets abroad, and, it might be the case, so his son was radicalized. That was a coincidence. People will say that, David. You know that. They will say, that's just the way it happens to be. He came from the region, whatever, whatever. We'll come back to that in a minute. I want you to talk about thousands of radicals coming into the country in the 90s. Now, we're talking about people who would follow a Wahhabi Salafist, philosophy of Islam, right?
Islam.
Exactly. Basically. Now, all I'm saying, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. You're going to think I'm an idiot. I'm not. I'm imagining there are listeners listening who don't know this stuff. This is basic stuff for you and for me. How did they get into the country? Who were these people? Where were they coming from in the 90s?
They were generally, coming over from Afghanistan. There were some other places as well. I can't quite remember, but yeah. They were veterans, of the Soviet-Afghan War, and they were let in for that reason, on the logic that my enemy's enemy is my friend, which is a very, very false logic, as we have seen time and time again in history, basically.
Yeah.
But what that obviously enabled was people with combat experience, with guerrilla warfare experience, bomb making, snipers, have all come out of the country with that expertise. And even if those people themselves were not actually involved, they're in position to be able to obviously train others. And obviously, again, with this reaction, I can't stress this enough. Whenever what they call terrorism, which is in fact resistance, occurs, it occurs where a people are utterly, utterly oppressed and denied the very rule of law, basically. That talking about Catholics in Northern Ireland in the late 60s. You had Protestants going in their homes and shooting them, for God's sake. And the IUC did nothing about it, or in some cases joined in. Now, in those circumstances, when the local police are involved in attacking you, what are you supposed to do?
Yeah.
Hold the band together and pick up a weapon and defend yourself. The same can be said of Palestine. The same
could be said on and on, but that's the segue point back to the, let me call it pulling the left's head out of its ass.
Fake news, and so we're trying to bring back and restore the fourth estate.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I wanted to get into that term with you. There's kind of been this weird bedfellows that have been created in the Trump era. Because on the one hand, Trump is attacking a lot of these corporate news agencies, calling them fake news, which I would say is correct. But he's calling them fake. Yeah, he's calling them fake news because they criticize him, which I see as part of like this larger war on journalism, which is any journalist who criticizes Trump is somehow fake news, whether corporate or independent. So I'm wondering, you know, how do you see that, being this independent journalist, given the contemporary context of the relationship between politicians and the media?
No, it's an interesting time in Trump land, because I would say that we agree with Trump that, you know, the corporate media is fake news, but we have to be really careful. And it's interesting because there is this trend where anything that Trump says, you know, people on the left are going to call him a psychopath or narcissistic or whatever. And so they've kind of jumped on this bandwagon of kind of attacking his attack on the media. But we have to be a little fair here and say that, you know, yeah, his criticism does come from the fact that the media is criticizing him. But that is the one area that I think that we can all agree that the corporate media is fake news. But what's really upsetting is that you're seeing people on the left, you know, all of a sudden they're citing the corporate media. They're leaning towards this, you know, the Hillary Clinton, CNN media, and other organizations like the New York Times and the Associated Press.
But they've obviously dragged a whole lot more people into it, including other European governments and Saudi Arabia.
Let me ask you this, my friend. Those thousands of men who came into the country in the 1990s, who had a different view of Islam, the Wahhabi, very extreme view, can it be argued that the mischief makers, the shadowy elites behind the scenes, they wanted them to come in because they wanted chaos to reign further down the road, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's all part of the plan. I mean, I think what actually happened was when they collapsed the former Sov bloc, the Eastern Europe and the communist countries, I think what their plan was to roll that out over a number of years. But things don't always go to plan for them. And I think what happened was when a few people saw this in the Eastern Bloc, they all revolted very quickly. So in terms of the world geopolitics, you've got this vacuum between the collapse of the Sov bloc and the Eastern Bloc countries and the rise of a new threat. In fact, the mid-1990s, defence spending in the US was cut for the first time since the Second World War, basically. You had a peace process in the Middle East, you had a peace process in Northern Ireland. It was all going very, very well. And obviously what we now look at is the Zionists thinking, well, no, we've now got to try and roll out our new form of terrorism and so on. We've been feeding these people like these Islamic extremists into the UK, but we need to trigger it with something else. Hence, hey, let's go for Gaddafi, get rid of Gaddafi, create chaos in North Africa, take it from there, basically.
This is incredible stuff. David Shaler is on the line, folks. He's a lot more than just a former MI5 officer agent, a lot more besides davidshaler.com, at gods_spy on Twitter. Was the Lockerbie bomb, which I remember I was a child, David, when I say I was a child, I would have been early teens, I suppose, and I'll never forget it. In Ireland, it got the blanket media coverage it got everywhere else. Was that an MI6, joint MI6 CIA operation to, you know, again, to blame Gaddafi, was it?
No, it wasn't, actually. I mean, I looked at this in some detail because I was the Libyan desk officer. Now, when Lockerbie actually happened, I was actually a journalist. By the time I, 1994, I'm an intelligence officer posted to the Libyan desk with responsibility for Lockerbie. So I have what is a conspiracy theorist wet dream. I can look at all the MI5 files. So,
so if it was Operation Trojan from Tel Aviv, well, you wouldn't. Nah. Anyway... you have to go to, by way of section, was it, I'll have to get back to you, oh, that book is not in my, anyway, damn it, I'll get back to the agent that wrote that name, but it's his baby.
Oh, I do, I go through them all with a fine-tooth comb, basically. And what transpired is those conspiracy theories seeking to blame either Iran or Syria or Iranian-backed groups were coming out of MI6. I also found that MI6 got a specific section called Information Operations, whose job it is to plant up stories that they say are favourable to the UK, but obviously are designed generally to discredit the enemies of MI6, basically, and I've been victim to that. David Icke's been victim of that. Anybody who stands up to these people will be a victim of that. Even Stella Remington, when she brought her book out, got the briefings and the attacks and so on. So I say, as soon as you step out of line, they have all these people in place in the media and so on. Now, again, this is unbelievable that MPs won't take my evidence in this area.
It's incredible. Won't
this. I mean, today I also tweeted the Daily Mail telling them that this story was theirs if they wanted it, and they didn't respond either, basically.
And you've given them, I mean, the documentation you have that you will publish on your website, yeah, it clearly shows and demonstrates that Ramadan al-Abadi, was that his name, his father?
Yeah, his name's actually redacted from that document, but if you were to remove the redaction, I can tell you with a 99% degree of certainty that that is Ramadan al-Abadi, basically.
And MI6 knew him as Agent Tunworth.
That's right, yeah, that was his code name, basically.
Christ almighty.
And so they say it's all incredible how it's come full circle.
Yeah, and they want us to believe that it was his son, acting on his own, was able to put together a very sophisticated bomb, evade security, look like an
understanding.
I was, because it's been closed ever since. I was a frequent visitor to the Manchester Arena, and security has always been lax there. That's not to criticise the men and women who work for ShowSec, which is the firm that does the security, but when you go to the actual gate with your ticket at the arena, of course it's going to bloody well change now, but until the attack, because we were at a take that gig only 3 days before it, don't laugh at me, we were there, and you walk up, and they had a cursory look at Caroline's handbag, and they did not search my coat. I was wearing a coat, they did not. They just passed us inside. You know, so anybody could have, I could have been wearing a belt, and walked in there and blown myself to pieces, and that would have been the end of...
So, on was the endless horror of... the Attack Fury Army attacking our foes along with the recent atrocities in the UK. So MI5's job is to provide deniability to the pirates up the Thames by pretending to look for their cloaked dagger backside, who set up the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group murder racket along with the US. And... But I gotta say that Libyan Islamic Fighting Group included Ramadan Abedi and, of course, his son, Salman Abedi? The killing of Abdul Wahab Hafida, ABDEL-WAHAB. H-A-F-I-D-A-H, Abdul Wahab Hafida, was an 18-year-old who news reports said was chased by a group of men, run over and stabbed in the neck in Manchester, England, in May 2016. In other words, a year before there's this event that demands justice. And if the slime buckets up the Thames, the pirates of the Potomac are mutually funding and backing and turning blind eyes to this murder racket, well, it's a murder racket. What are they going to do when something like that happens to the Manchester boys? Saying not that the remote detonated backpack that the son of Ramadan agent Tunworth. Okay, let me just get out of the way and let's find out some more about Agent MI6 Agent Tunworth from the agent that was working in there until this made him too sick.
I understand that Khan would be revisited on him. So this is to say, it's a really, in a nutshell, the problems that we face in this country today. We've lost our representation, and we've got to look for a different way forward in which we don't trust these people anymore. And the only way we stop them, essentially, is by not putting our money into their coffers. That will then get them to wake up because we're no longer funding it.
Spot on. When you talked about knowing about...
We knew he'd had contact with them, with ICE.
And basically owning the so-called Al-Qaeda group. That, you knew about that, and I suppose at the time some independent media commentators like David, Alex Jones back in the day, and others were talking about who these Al-Qaeda guys really were, but the public at large, David, didn't know about it. You know what scares me more than anything, and you've been on this journey longer than I have, what really does genuinely scare me, and again, I always preface this by saying we don't do fear porn. What scares me right now is I think the public at large do know that this so-called Islamic State group was deliberately set up to destabilise Syria. They know because all the info is out there. They know because it's been said, even in the MSM, through RT, through other agencies, particularly in France, where the national media in France has covered this by bringing former foreign ministers onto programmes to say that they were back in London in 2009, and the security agencies in London were telling Roland Dumas, for example, the former foreign minister under Mitterrand, they were saying to him, we're going to do something in Syria. It's all out there, David. It's all out there. The oil dealings, Turkey supplying ISIS with what they need, selling oil on the cheap. And yet it doesn't appear to be making any difference in terms of the public reaction. Why? Why is that?
Well, because the public have, start with the public having very short memories. Anybody who tell you campaigns knows you've got to keep banging messages out there all the time because people forget, basically, and that's on one level.
Another level, they don't
really have time to look at these things
properly
for themselves.
They
had the luxury of having, once I blew the whistle, having...
So on that subject,
resistance,
latest in the Clinton body count here. Oh, wrong mouse again. Okay. Latest in the Clinton body count. Klaus Eberwein. Oh, I got turned down. The mic. Okay. Now. Okay. Latest on the Clinton body count. Klaus Eberwein. Oh, well, let's just start with... it's written on the wall in case I forgot. Seth Rich. Okay. Yeah, he was the one that provided the leak. We know because the exception that proved the rule, Julian Assange, said he was the one that provided the leak about the theft of the election from Bernie Sanders and all. And about the funding of the death squads that they're talking about, murdering my stunt double Gaddafi in Libya and all. But Klaus Eberwein, former Haitian government official, was found dead Tuesday, that was 1 week ago, in South, that was 7-Eleven, easy to remember, like the store on the corner used to be, in a South Bay motel room in what the Miami-Dade Medical Examiner Office is ruling a suicide. Quote, he shot himself in the head, unquote, said Veronica Lamar, Miami-Dade Medical Examiner record supervisor. She listed his time of death, 12:19 p.m., address where Eberwein's body was discovered, according to police, 14501 South Dixie Highway, is Quality Inn. Supporter of former Haitian President Michael Martelly, Eberwein served as Director General of the government's Economic Development Agency funds the Assistance Economique et Sociale, better known as FAES. He held the position from May 2012 until February 2015, when he was replaced. He was also a partner in a popular pizza restaurant in Haiti, Munchies, and has a pizza, the Claus special, named after him. It was really shocking, said Munchies owner Gilbert Bailey. We grew up together. He was like family. Bailey said he last spoke to Abel Wine 52 weeks ago, and he was in good spirits. They were working on opening a Munchies restaurant in Sunrise, he said, but it appears that Abel Wine had fallen on hard times. An Uber spokesperson confirmed that he worked as a driver for a while in South Florida. During and after his government tenure, Aberwine faced allegations of fraud and corruption on how the agency he headed administered funds. Among the issues was Spay's oversight of shoddy construction of several schools built after Haiti's devastating January 12, 2010 earthquake. Oh, DJ Mouse aside, so Stephen Jones showed us the seismographs, and you can see a sine wave on a Richter scale. It doesn't belong there unless there's a Tesla earthquake generator, and they use the HARP array, and you can see it over the attack on Japan, so that they in Japan, China wouldn't drop the dollar. The economists were warned, you know, look what happened to Indonesia when they wouldn't open the Straits of Malacca. And so, Catherine Austin Fitz commented on the Thai Baht, the short selling. They knew that that was going to 15% of the economy that was ready for that, and they made money off of that tsunami. Operation SEAL started in 43, but they didn't need a nuke. Now they got this. And they used the oil creep. But anyway, this is back to the Clinton body count. So Klaus Eberwein killed 7-Eleven a week ago. In Dade County, he used to be Martelli's during after the earthquake and the Clinton corruption scandal. So, suspect starts with Seth Rich, has Thorne, and half a dozen people right around the election. But more specifically, Agent Turnbull. Let me get out of the way so we can finish.
It stinks. I mean, this is a massive scandal, David. And you're giving this to the politicians and to the national newspapers, and they don't want to know.
Well, it seems that with these current wave of attacks, these people are actually known to the intelligence services, but the intelligence services don't act against them. Now, you know, I'm not going to criticise them for that necessarily, because we don't know the detail or the reliability of the information they were in possession of. It's very easy to talk with hindsight. So when you're doing an intelligence investigation, it's like doing a 1,000-piece jigsaw, and you've got about 30% of the pieces and no picture on the box. You know, it's a lot of it is semi-informed guessing, basically. So I'm not going to criticise them for that, but for the active MI6 support of Tunworth, that clearly gave them expertise, the fact they were sponsoring him and these other Manchester Taliban to try and assassinate Gaddafi, appointment Gaddafi, I say, has renounced terrorism and is looking for a rapprochement with the West, basically.
Yeah.
This is how sick the whole thing is. It's like this ridiculous kind of middle-class boys' game, although they're now obviously very ably supported by a number of middle-class women as well, basically doing all of this. And I say it has no respect for human life. It seems that they have to take these people and send them to public schools and turn them into psychopaths. That's the problem with our MPs. Something like about 35% of our MPs went to public school. A lot of them would have boarded and so on. That's not a normal life. You don't form normal family relationships. You don't form normal friendships where you go home at the end of the day. What you form are power alliances. So they use that as a way of training up the political class. When I say that, I'm including the intelligence services, the media, the judiciary, and so on, basically, to essentially be psychopaths to do their bidding. And I was thinking about it again the other day. Every so often I just go back to it and just think about Blair's incredible attempt to justify the invasion of Iraq and just seeing the empty eyes of a self-justifying psychopath, a man who has no empathy for what he's actually done, for the suffering that he's caused other human beings. And I say people can have a go at me about all sorts of stuff, but I will tell you now, I have not caused harm to anybody in this process. And obviously I have been tempted. When the member of Libyan intelligence comes to you and you've just got out the nick and you're put in that nick for trying to expose this story, or in fact tell the government about it, and he offers you millions, name your price, obviously, in those moments, he's done his research. That's when you try and pitch somebody, is when they've got a reason for them to be pissed off at their own government. And obviously, in my circumstances, that was a very tempting offer, but I said no, because obviously, any information I gave to them would be used to kill people, for the British in Libya, and obviously, that's never why I did this. But at times, the other side were trying to provoke me into doing that because they don't give a stuff about any of that stuff. I say to them, we're just pawns. They were definitely at points trying to provoke me into naming officers on the internet and stuff like that. But I didn't do that. And I say, even, and again, Rich, I know that I can't remember if I've mentioned this in public, but I put that MI6 document on the internet in 1999. It's a strange story how I got hold of it again. But I was the one that redacted it. That's why I can tell you it's run with a baby on it, basically. And that document, as I say, appeared after a foreign secretary had said, this is pure fantasy with no basis in fact. Now, when people hear that, they think, God, Shayla must be the biggest fantasist in the world. God, there's no basis in fact. This is making up stuff to embarrass the services. Now, obviously, when that document then appears on the internet, it actually shows that MI6 did have a relationship with this coup plotter. The document makes clear he's involved. It obviously doesn't mention the payments have been made. It's not that sort of document. But it mentions the attack before it happens and crucially, therefore, predicts what's going to happen. It's not somebody trying to impress somebody by seeing an attack and then saying, oh, it was them. The fact that their modus operandi is delivered before in this report, before the actual attack happens, shows it's them when it happens, basically. So this is absolutely incontrovertible. On all levels, we have a foreign secretary who lied to cover up on behalf of murderers in MI6, and yet nobody in the mainstream media seems to think there's anything wrong with that.
No.
Now, I say this is where we are in this, and obviously, Richard, I can just shift the focus a little bit. And we talk about a lot of stuff like this security, but with my other hat on, the spiritual hat on, that is what is going on at the moment. I've said that this year was going to be a spectacular year one way or the other, and I don't think anybody can dispute that. We have been shaken to our foundations in some ways. But that, to me, is because we've lost touch with the essential true law, the law of love your neighbours, you love yourself. We're obsessed with rules, and rules are just there for psychopaths, basically. Psychopaths can follow a rule that causes all sorts of harm to a human being and say, oh, well, not my problem, mate, I'm just following the rule kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Can I, before we segue into that, right, because this is very important as well, we accept, do we, that the intelligence services might have known that Salman Abedi was about to pull the trigger and kill people, and for reasons of certain gains that they could make from that, legislation they could bring in, the encroaching police state they want to bring in, they knew Abedi was going to do it and yet turned a blind eye and left him do it. Is that a strong possibility?
Again, yeah, we could go through different theories. I mean, even the fact to say it's not beyond the information we have to reasonably conclude that MI6 may have been somehow fanning this whole thing. Or even beyond that, if we go into the real deep state, that someone, somewhere, who is very, very powerful is setting up MI6. That's the one thing I just can't get out of my head. Sometimes with these things, I look at them and I just get this boom. A bit like with the Gareth Williams, the spy in the bag case, where the first thing I thought was, this is somebody showing MI6 they can't protect one of their operatives in their own safe house. That's got to be somebody who is very, very powerful, basically. So it's almost like somebody behind the scenes is setting up MI6. And I've always postulated the idea that there is a good secret society there. People use the term Illuminati in the wrong way. We've certainly had recently the Illuminati declaring over the last couple of years saying that we're...
Well, I think he's straight, runs off the road a little bit, but the London Gladio B Notorious was 7-7, and we had Peter Power come on BBC saying, Advisor Consulting, we were drilling bombs at those four locations at those four times. So they take a drill live, just like there was all those drills that they said was the reason that they didn't have fighters, they were off on drills. Well, you take the drill live. Blah, blah, blah.
Different. I obviously believe, because it's been my experience, the vast majority of people who adhere to or subscribe to any religion, no matter which one it is, Judaism, Christianity, whatever, Islam, whatever, they're decent people, they pay their taxes, they want to get on with life, and they want to raise their families, and so on. But I'm not an idiot. Things are not black and white, there are shades of grey. There are obviously some people who do subscribe to the Wahhabi Salafi view. How does that relate to the thousands of people who came into the country in the 1990s with those views? And with that in mind, what sort of genuine radical threat exists in this country, in your opinion?
Well, I think that the radical threat has, been created by denying the rule of law, hasn't it? I mean, obviously, the most glaring example we have is where Muslims are blamed for 9/11, when there's no evidence to show that at all. In fact, the only actual evidence we have of anybody being likely is, in fact, Israel. We know that there are reports that hundreds of Israeli operatives were rounded up.
Oh, Christ, Stephen Shearer. Operation Northwoods was 62 Lemnitzer memo saying we will use drones, we will have a false flag attack from Cuba, and then we will attack Cuba. So the blueprint is in there. So how do you stage a false flag attack and then blame it on somebody else? Anyway, they are put there by us as much as they are the Frankenstein run amok. Keep the inside, they have inside jobs on their territory when an inside job is done on U.S. territory. It has the full cooperation of insiders.
We know that we know about the dancing Israelis. We know about the Israelis rested on one of the bridges in New York that day. They've claimed they were following around these people, but actually, there's not much evidence of those people actually really existing. When we consider that,
and then he talks about the hijackers, but really, okay, look at the first target, cui bono. Was Marsh McLennan and Cantor Fitzgerald, who were laundering the World War II loot, the bonds for false off record sheet funds were transferred in the aftermath, but they became due on September 12th from 10 years before. So that was how we bought up the Russian industry and generals and crash the rubles with General Pugov doing the three bullets to the head suicide along the way. Never mind.
Seven of them claimed to be still alive. We started to realize that obviously they were the people we say were responsible for 9/11 were just a series of false identities, which could have obviously been used by those Israeli operatives. If they really were carrying out the surveillance, as they said, why didn't they pass more on to the FBI? Why didn't they make more efforts to stop those attacks? So you can kind of see why people of a particular mindset, and again, I mean, if I was a young Muslim lad, I can understand that if you're seeing this burning injustice against your people, you would feel a need to do something about that. That is the problem. I mean, you know, what I can't understand is when we have these programs, everybody just looks so bemused. Oh, Manchester's being bombed by an evil Islamic terrorist. We just can't understand why this is happening. And it's like I live in a parallel universe to them. What, you mean you don't remember the last 15 years of war, the white phosphorus, the depleted uranium, the refugee crisis you've created? You've destroyed these people's lives. And then you wonder why you get a bit of blowback, if that is indeed the case of what this is.
But yet the majority of Muslims in this country, the vast majority, like you and I, they're disgusted by UK, US, NATO foreign policy, the destruction that we've wrought on those countries, the murder. And yet the vast majority of men and women who go to the mosque wouldn't entertain the idea of taking up arms because they're peace-loving.
It's like all of us, isn't it, Richie?
Yeah.
Obviously, during my case, obviously, there are times you think this democratic system doesn't work.
Yeah.
Stuff people need to know. And you get tempted. You kind of start thinking, should I go down that route? But obviously, you're a sane human being. You don't. Because one of the reasons I blew the whistle was to stop people having to suffer bereavements and so on because of terrorist attacks. If I then go down the same route and start killing people, I'm just creating that problem.
Can I ask you a question on that, David? Because the point I was trying to make, and I know I'm not making it very well, and it's not because I'm trying to be politically correct. I sometimes struggle to really explain what it is I'm trying to get at. The Wahhabi Salafi ideology, which we know was created ultimately by the British government, by the British Army. We know this way, way back when. But that ideology exists, and that didn't come out of the dreadful things that happened in Iran, 1953, Mossadegh, everything else, the destruction of Iran in the early 1980s because of the Iran-Iraq war, when we gave Saddam all the weaponry and all the money he needed, all the terrible things we've done. But we can differentiate, we can separate away from that the Wahhabi ideology, which seems to be a misogynistic, hateful, kind of murdering ideology anyway on its own. And I'm trying to establish, and I can't establish, how serious is that? And is there a lot of that about? That's the question I'm trying to kind of get to the bottom of.
Well, when the Pakistani generals were asking, okay, tell us what this Islam business is, clerics couldn't come up with a straight answer. So, but I'm not going to look at Pakistan. I'm going to look at Sudan, where the Islamic Brotherhood was a state religion under General Namiri. And in 1985, Norman Shumway sent me a letter, which I have copied, and said, even the president couldn't stop the execution of Muhammad Taha for refusing to adopt the state religion. Of course, he was Christian, and he was murdered. Now, it's very interesting to look at what kind of group he was part of. Women were very empowered in that brand of Islam. And actually, he wasn't Christian, but because if you look into it, the news stories at the time, 1985, that was what was passed along. Or maybe he was or wasn't, but that's not the point. It's that the government of Sudan was being funded by the West against the Soviets. So that was 1985, and yet Sudan wound up on the post 9/11 hit list because after the fall of the Soviet Union, you need a new boogeyman. Well, General Namiri, State Islam, was passed along to whoever, but they became the boogeyman, and the fracking operation, you see all those countries Wesley Clark named, included Sudan. So 1985, I couldn't stop funding the very thing that is used then to attack, and it was the sins of the North against the South that was the cause for division, and there's always such sins to exploit, and then there's more sins, you know, between this group and that. And that goes on and on in South Sudan. But let's just be clear about some of that stuff.
No, again, I don't think there's a lot of it about, but you don't need many of these people to create chaos, do you? So it's only extreme elements it will embed with. You've got to be a bit of a psychopath in the first place. What is more interesting about Wahhabi Islam, as I say, that violent Islam basically is a front for Zionism. We know that ISIS fighters have been treated by Israeli doctors. We know that ISIS has been funded by God knows who in Syria, basically. Yeah. Just about every Western government seems to have got their tuppence within it in somewhere at some point. And so they are a front for Zionism. That's what you've got to see this thing. I found out today, apparently, Tommy Robinson's a Zionist. So he has no problem with what the state of Israel does to all those terrible, those people in Gaza, all the terrible injuries and shootings it inflicts on people, and it leaves a knife there afterwards. He's not bothered by any of that, of course.
No, because his dot is the only dot. He's just another Bill O'Reilly or Ann Coulter or Richard Littlejohn. He's just another extreme version of those people. My dot is the only dot. He did an interview with a friend of mine recently, and he was wearing an Israeli Defense Forces t-shirt. I was really glad it was my friend interviewing him, because I would have torn him apart for that. It's absolutely ludicrous. How do you define Zionism for people? Because we're at this stage, the Home Secretary today, Amber Rudd, and I didn't get a chance to play the audio because I ran out of time. And there's no way I'm eating into your time, mate. I'm delighted you're back on the programme. I wanted to play a clip earlier. She talked about plans to deal with the failure of the state to prevent Manchester and London. One of those plans is to become much, much harder on non-violent extremism. They want to become harder on people who access terror sites. Now, the parallel you can draw here is they're saying that going onto a terror website and reading terrorist propaganda is just as bad as if you're downloading or watching kiddie porn, which is ludicrous. But that's what basically what they're saying. And they are suggesting that we punish much harder people who are reading terrorist material online. This is really sinister. Now, the point I'm trying to make is, at some stage, people are going to say Zionism is... basically, they're going to say that Zionism is as bad a word as nigger. That's what they're going to say. They're going to say it's a racist word by somebody who's too cowardly to blame the ills of the world on the Jewish people. Now, you and I know, you know, of course, we differentiate between Zionism and Jews, of course we do. But this is what they're going to do, David. This is the reaction to events like we saw in London and Manchester. We've got to deal with non-violent extremism. So when somebody says to you, hey, Shaler, how do you identify, how do you, give me your definition for the term Zionism, or Zionist, what do you say?
Well, the first definition of Zionism is to do with the promised land from the Bible, land promised by God to Abraham and his descendants. And obviously, a lot of people in Israel, therefore, have claimed this, that is that land in Israel. And therefore, Zionism in the first instance is about the return to the Holy Land or the promised land. However, anybody who's read the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and has had their eyes open for the last 20 years will know that Zionism is really about the subjugation of mankind. That wherever there's peace, they will create all sorts of violence and war and so on. But it's not just assault through war, it's assault through propaganda, it's through poisoning us. It's, I mean, at the moment, this is where I say this is the spiritual mission, is because we are being, mankind's being assaulted from all sides.
Now, Behold the Pale Horrors by William Cooper republishes parts of that, explaining that Sion, S-C-I-O-N, is the true meaning there. And it means, you know, the male heir, eldest male heir. And so that's just basic materialism, because, anyway.
Amber Rudd here is not going to solve the problem by clamping down on people who aren't actually involved in the terrorism. That will only, again, radicalise more Muslims. It's a bit like locking up Catholic people from Northern Ireland without trial in the early 1970s. They thought that would solve the conflict, and it didn't, of course. There were a lot of innocent people who then did join the IRA and did subsequently become resistance fighters, so we had 30 years of conflict, basically.
And terrorists as well. They did some very bad things.
What frustrates me, Richie, so much is I've got this expertise. I know these things.
You know these things, yeah.
The modicum of understanding about things like terrorism and so on would know that is the very worst thing you can do.
Yeah. I know. I'd love to know the name of the hotel. I know them all, from the expensive ones to the cheaper ones, the rooming houses. He committed suicide by putting a plastic bag around his head, we read here, and this is from the Chicago Tribune. Let me fully credit this story. Catherine Skiba, David Heintzman, Todd Lighty. These are the three reporters from the Chicago Tribune who put this together. See, everybody's getting into the act. It's really a harvest. So he's in a room in Rochester, Minnesota, near the Mayo Clinic. And according to this story, the police say no reason to think he was murdered, no idea of foul play. The Chicago Tribune has obtained a Minnesota state death record filed in Olmsted County. That's Rochester, Minnesota. Right? Sort of southeast Minnesota, south central maybe, saying Smith committed suicide near the Mayo Clinic in this hotel at 1:17 p.m. afternoon on Sunday, May 14th. He was found with a bag over his head and a source of helium attached to that. So that's apparently a way to end one's own life. A medical examiner's report gives the same account, and no foul play whatsoever. Now, there's a note. The note says no foul play whatsoever was involved in his death. He wrote that he was taking his own life because of a recent bad turn in health since January 1917, and the timing is related to life insurance of $5 million, which is now expiring. He had been staying at the hotel for several days, had extended his stay, was expected to check out. Tomorrow is my last day, he said to a hotel employee on May 13th. Now, well, this is a fascinating story, right? Who would have a motive to end the life of this man, right? Does this story make sense that it's a suicide?